Today is Tuesday, July 8th. Oh, 9th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a warning from the U.S. president as Iran says it has enriched higher levels of uranium.
Iran better be careful. Because you enriched for one reason. And I won't tell you what that reason is. But it's no good. They better be careful.
An American billionaire financier is arrested on child sex trafficking charges. Also ahead, a Holocaust survivor who spent her life teaching forgiveness has died. It's all on today's International Edition. A U.S. hedge fund billionaire with links to top politicians and celebrities was charged Monday with running a sex trafficking ring that allegedly exploited dozens of underage girls. In an indictment, Jeffrey Berman, a federal prosecutor in New York, accused Jeffrey Epstein of allegedly paying the girls hundreds of dollars for nude or partially nude massages that increasingly were sexual in nature.
Beginning in at least 2002 and continuing until 2005, Epstein is alleged to have abused dozens of victims by causing them to engage in sex acts with him at his mansion in New York and at his estate in Palm Beach, Florida.
Prosecutors said a search of Epstein's mansion in Manhattan also uncovered evidence of hundreds and perhaps thousands of nude photographs of what appeared to be underage girls. In a court appearance, he pleaded not guilty to the charges. Joining us now to talk more about this is Haley Halverson, Vice President of Advocacy and Outreach with the National Center on Sexual Exploitation. Thank you so much for being with us. So what do you know about what this man is accused of doing?
So he has been accused of recruiting and abusing underage individuals, probably more than 30 underage women who were then sexually abused by Epstein, allegedly. And prior to this, he had a guilty plea, but it was part of a plea deal with prosecutors where he only spent 13 months in jail. And this is someone, again, he abused so many of these individuals. But now that it was declared that federal prosecutors broke the law by concealing this plea agreement by not talking about it with the victims. The people who were harmed by Epstein should have been consulted under federal law before he was given this, frankly, incredible plea deal for systemic sexual abuse. So that has now been overturned, and prosecutors say that he now faces up to 45 years in prison, which means that he could spend the rest of his life in jail if it goes through.
Someone like him, when they say running a sex trafficking ring exploiting underage girls, what exactly does that mean? What is he accused of specifically doing?
So recruiting or enticing, which is offering money to underage girls, which obviously have to come to him through a network, right? So there's other individuals that are involved in bringing these girls towards him. And typically it seemed like there was a lot of illicit massage going on and then with escalating sexual activity from there. And allegedly he abused dozens of underage girls as young as 14 as well. So, you know, there have been some news stories that have covered this, saying that he is in trouble for abusing, quote unquote, underage sex workers or underage, quote unquote, prostitutes. But the reality is that under federal law, anyone under the age of 18 is a sex trafficking victim. And I think that it's really important for us as a society to recognize anyone under the age of 18 who's being paid for sex, whether that's through money or anything of value, could be a place to sleep that night, is a sex trafficking victim, which means that we need to hold the individuals who are abusing them, we need to hold them accountable.
Right. So in other words, what you're saying is there's no such thing as an underage prostitute.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I also think it's been an interesting year. You know, there have been a string of billionaires who've been caught buying women for sex. Obviously, Robert Kraft, the CEO of the New England Patriots, was arrested. Also, Jim Bissonnette, the founder of a $3 billion hedge fund, was busted in a prostitution sting this year. And I think that we're at a time in our society where really the reality of the power imbalance in the sex trade has never been more clear. The reality that it's individual individuals with wealth and money and sexual entitlement who think that they have a right to purchase another person for sex, whether in sex trafficking or in prostitution, where individuals are driven to it out of a desperation of economic need, drug dependency, reliving past childhood sexual abuse and trauma, etc. So I think it's important to recognize that Jeffrey Epstein's in the news right now, but he's not alone. And unfortunately, he's not even alone in the billionaire class. Surveys have found that between 13 or even as high as 20% of men in America have bought sex at least once in their lives. And so I think it's a really important time for us to step back and look at the harm of sex buying and how that leads to the demand for sex trafficking, such as in the case of Jeffrey Epstein.
We also know that Epstein is pretty well connected with some pretty large names, including former President Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, the current president.
Great Britain's Prince Andrew. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is something that reaches both across the aisle and across the pond. And, you know, I think it's fascinating to see the fact that there really was this network associated with him of high-powered individuals. You know, we don't know what that means for any of those individuals. But I think we see that sex buyers are often highly esteemed in society, from obviously this extreme example to on local levels. Sex buyers could be policemen or judges or pastors, individuals that people think are great guys. So I think that is fascinating to see, and that's something that this case highlights. And then also the fact that, you know, he does have connections to people on both sides of the aisle. I think sex buying and sex trafficking are issues of male sexual entitlement that can show up across the political spectrum.
All right. Thank you so much for your perspective. And this is Haley Halverson. She's the Vice President of Advocacy and Outreach with the National Center on Sexual Exploitation. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. President Trump says he won't deal with the British ambassador who disparaged him. The African Union launches a continent-wide free trade area. Lebanon moves to oust Syrian refugees as the army bulldozes concrete homes. And the Ukrainian immigrant prodigy creates a unique DNA robot. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The United Nations Atomic Energy Agency has confirmed Iran has surpassed uranium enrichment limits spelled out in the 2015 nuclear deal. The International Atomic Energy Agency said its inspectors verified Monday that Iran had surpassed the set limits set in the accord aimed at restraining Tehran's ability to develop nuclear weapons in return for sanction relief. U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew the U.S. from the nuclear deal last year and imposed tough sanctions on Iran. Tehran has already pulled out of the parts of the agreement and is threatening to move further and further away from it unless the remaining parties, Britain, China, France, Germany, and Russia, provide economic relief from the crippling U.S. sanctions. Joining us now to talk more about the developments is Benham Bentaleblou, senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. What do you make of Iran's latest actions?
Well, I think this is more proof of Iran's strategy, which remains, in my view, graduate escalation. Yes, they're still trying to wait out the president, but this is their response to the president's very effective max pressure campaign. I think that the Iranians here are not making a dash towards a weapon. They're also not rushing to grow 20% enriched uranium, which is something that really helps get the transatlantic community together under the Obama administration for a united Western pressure policy against Iran. It's reported that Iran is not going to breach 5%, but in the next 60 days, and Iran, again, is phasing its escalation here, designed to get the West to swerve before it abandons course. Iran said it might go up to 20%, but for right now, it's going up to just under 5%, and this is designed, again, to get the West to cease its sanctions, to get Europe to come on board, to get America to act like it wants a deal more than Iran needs a deal. And it's a very calculated move by the U.S. Yes, it's a breach of the deal. deal, but it's an attempt by Iran to make up politically what market forces have done to the Iranian economy.
By all indications, Iran was complying with the deal arranged, and then it seems like the rhetoric and the tensions started heating up since the U.S. pulled out of that deal. Do you think we would have been better off just staying in it and having Iran comply, even if it wasn't the best deal?
No, because there's a difference between a deal that isn't the best deal and a deal that actually helps Iran get a nuclear weapon down the line. And most unfortunately, that's what the JCPOA does. It handicaps Western pressure. It handcuffs America's most powerful sanctions tools. And if you look at the attempts to actually get sanctions on Iran that are even non-nuclear during this era, they were treated as poison pill ways to kill the deal because everyone is rushing to defend this fatally flawed deal. So that aside, I think Iran saw this, Iran understood this, but the administration, when they left the deal, did not leave the deal citing issues of compliance. They left the deal citing this unfair trade, meaning that the most powerful, non-kinetic, non-military American tools of coercion and punishment and deterrence become handicapped for this deal, which ultimately paves Iran's way towards a nuclear weapon. So that dynamic is what made the Trump administration ultimately leave the nuclear deal after, again, attempting to fix the deal.
It seemed as though they were not enriching uranium, and now they are. So wouldn't that make it more of a threat?
The Iranians temporarily, per the deal, curb their enrichment of uranium, starting in 2013 and then again starting and then seeing that more so in 2015. But it's worth noting that Iran has never ceased the enrichment of uranium on its soil since 2006, something five UN Security Council resolutions required it to do. One of the reasons that both the interim and final nuclear deals are so bad is exactly because of this, that in the face of five UN Security Council resolutions, Iran beat back an international consensus and said the world's foremost state-sponsored terrorism was able to out-negotiate D5 plus one and not even suspend all enrichment of uranium in Iran for a single day. And so they won that. They didn't win the right, but they won a diplomatic victory against the international community when the JCPOA entered into force. Now, yes, Iran is taking more risky moves. It is escalating because, again, the sanctions are biting, and Iran is again trying to tell the world that it's not going to take the Trump administration's pressure policy lying down, because it's afraid that if it takes it lying down, that might incentivize others who are afraid to put pressure on Iran for a host of others, including the regime's malign and destabilizing activities, to actually not be afraid and to carry that out.
What other options does the United States and the Europeans, for that matter, have besides really tough sanctions, something that would not further destabilize the Middle East?
Well, I think that we have to understand right now the situation is quite unstable and it's risky. And again, I would liken it to a game of chicken right now. It is all about risk taking, but it's about responsible risk taking and measured risk taking and making sure the other side sees the signal that you are sending and doesn't misread the signal. I'm all for Washington's, hardening of military assets in the region. But if that sends a signal of weakness as opposed to a signal of strength, then of course there's no point in taking the risk of engaging in such a move. But all of this aside, I think right now Iran wants to gradually turn up the pressure on Washington, gradually turn up the pressure on the Europeans, and it's going to continue to act out in the region to say that you can't afford to pursue this pressure policy and abandon course. The first thing the transatlantic community needs to do is to not abandon course. There's a very significant role for Europe here, given that they're the only other Western parties in the JCPOA nuclear deal, and they have the ability to actually collapse the deal from within. So if Iran actually does continue to grossly violate the deal, and I would cite this recent escalation, this recent breaching of Iran past 3.67% as a violation, then the Europeans are able to escalate this issue through this joint commission process, which can take up to 60 days, and then actually collapse the deal from within and return to that international consensus that existed from 2006 to 2010 on Iran's nuclear program. It's about diplomatic pressure. Max pressure has been very successful from an economic standpoint, but diplomatically, America's some of its foremost allies, in the transatlantic community, have been standing with Iran, the world's foremost state-sponsored terrorism. And returning to that international consensus would return this Western consensus on Iran. And I think that is a powerful diplomatic tool in the pressure campaign against Iran.
All right, that's Ben Talablu, senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Thank you for being with us. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, has condemned the conditions of detention in which refugees and migrants are being held on the southern border of the United States. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the High Commissioner's headquarters in Geneva.
UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet calls conditions in these detention camps appalling for both adult and child refugees and migrants, but especially so for the children. Her spokeswoman, Ravina Shamdasani, tells VOA the High Commissioner, as a former pediatrician and as a mother, grandmother, and former head of state, feels personally stricken by the plight of the children.
She's deeply shocked from all these perspectives at the way that children are being forced to sleep on the floor in overcrowded facilities without access to adequate health care or food, separated from their families in many circumstances, and with very poor sanitation conditions. And these are conditions that have been documented by the Department of Homeland Security's Office of the Inspector General itself.
Shamdasani says any deprivation of liberty for child and adult migrants should be a measure of last resort. She says the UN Rights Office is concerned about the U.S. government's management policy, which seems to be based on detecting, detaining, and deporting irregular migrants.
This is particularly egregious when in the case of children, who in many cases are being separated from their families, being held in horrid detention conditions. The many different UN human rights bodies have found that the detention of migrant children may constitute cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, which is, of course, prohibited by international law.
Shamdasani says children should never be held in immigration detention or separated from their families. She says doing so may cause irreparable harm to the child's development and well-being. Kevin McAleenan, the acting secretary of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, maintained on Sunday that reports of unsanitary conditions and inadequate food and water are unsubstantiated. In a recent television interview, he said steps are being taken to improve the detention centers. Some members of the U.S. Congress are also calling for the improved treatment of migrants being held in U.S. custody. Migrant arrests by the U.S. Border Patrol this year have hit the highest level since 2007. In May alone, agents detained nearly 133,000 refugees and migrants, including more than 11,500 unaccompanied children. Shamdasani tells VOA migration is a very complex issue. She says the U.S., Mexico, and Central American countries have to work together to address the root causes compelling migrants to leave their homes. She adds this needs to be done in a way that puts the human rights of the migrants front and center of any policies that are adopted. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Australia is closely tracking a high-tech Chinese spy ship that's believed to be on its way to monitor war games off the Queensland coast. Australian defense officials suspect the ship will try to gather information as the multinational military drills begin. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Chinese ship is fitted with advanced communication systems to eavesdrop on other forces. The AGI, or Auxiliary General Intelligence Vessel, was thought to be north of Papua New Guinea, Australia's nearest neighbour, over the weekend, on a journey that's expected to end off the coast of Queensland. It's thought the ship will closely monitor huge joint military exercises from just outside Australian territory. For the first time, Japanese forces are involved in military drills in Australian waters with the United States. Experts believe the Chinese have particular interest in the Japanese Amphibious Rapid Deployment Brigade and how it operates with its US and Australian counterparts. It was formed last year, partly in response to tensions in the East China Sea. Japan has control of the uninhabited Senkaku Islands, although Beijing also claims them under another name. Lieutenant General Greg Bilton, the Chief of Defence Joint Operations, says Australia will keep a close watch of the movement of the Chinese surveillance vessel.
In regards to the AGI, we believe there is one north of Australia at the moment. We're tracking it. We don't know yet what its destination is, but we're assuming that it will come down to the east coast of Queensland, and we'll take appropriate measures in regards to that. It is international waters. They have the right to sail there. I'm not going to go into operational details, but we'll just take appropriate actions in regards to that. It's a vessel that collects information, so it's not a great threat, but we'll take appropriate action.
Analysts believe the presence of the Chinese ship highlights a double standard from the superpower. They believe that while China will be exercising its rights under a United Nations convention to monitor the war games in international waters, it often forces foreign ships out of its self-declared military alert zones. Up to 25,000 military personnel from the United States and Australia, as well as Canada, New Zealand and Japan, are taking part in Exercise Talisman Sabre that runs until August. They're held every 2 years. In 2017, a Chinese surveillance ship was spotted off eastern Australia during the manoeuvres. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
U.S. President Donald Trump on Monday claimed that America is leading the world on environmental issues, defying criticism from environmental groups who've blasted his steps to slash green regulations and back out of global efforts to fight climate change. Trump touted the fact that the U.S. has become the world's biggest oil and gas producer.
For years, politicians told Americans that a strong economy and a vibrant energy sector were incompatible with a healthy environment. In other words, one thing doesn't go with the other, and that's wrong because we're proving the exact opposite.
The administration has also touted that U.S. water and air quality remain among the best in the world, but critics have noted that air and water quality have slipped in recent years after years of improvements following the imposition of stronger environmental regulations. Joining us to talk about all of it is Heather McTeer-Tony. She is a former regional administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency Southeast Region under President Obama and the current Moms Clean Air Force National Field Director. Tell us your reaction to the president's speech on the environment.
There were claims that this administration has been a leader on the environment. However, I think most Americans would know that is hogwash at best. This administration was talking about how they were attempting to go after foreign polluters and needing to hold people accountable and focusing on innovation, when in reality, this administration has done everything except that. So standing there alongside former lobbyists for the oil industry, it was quite laughable to many of us in the environmental world, and I think Americans, period.
Did he go into any specifics as to what he would be referring to that he had done to protect the environment?
No, there was not. I don't think there was any way he could go into anything specific other than to say that his administration was trying to protect American jobs and was trying to ensure that the economy was protected in a way that the former administration, the Obama administration, had not. And you know, that was really, I think, very dismissive of the work that both EPA as an agency and the people who are just career folks who work there each and every day. The administration, the Trump administration, has at this point attempted to roll back almost 83 regulations from former administrations that are protective of human health and the environment. And the EPA's mission is to protect human health and the environment. So right now they are in the process of trying to roll back things like the Clean Car Standards and the Mercury and Air Toxic Standards, things that we know and that this administration has even admitted save tens of thousands of lives each and every day. They refuse to hold polluters that are domestic right here in our own backyard accountable for their actions, and the entire time working to eradicate things that protect the most vulnerable. So for one instance of the press release, the current EPA administrator, Mr. Wheeler, was talking about protecting vulnerable communities. At the same time, this agency under his leadership has cut EPA costs and almost gutted completely agencies like environmental justice and civil rights within the EPA. So again, it's a show. It's laughable that they're trying to say they're environmental leaders when we all know the very first thing this administration did was to pull our country out of the Paris Climate Accord, removing us from the conversation that the globe is having about environmental leadership right now.
What exactly is Moms Clean Air Force?
So Moms Clean Air Force is an organization of over 1.2 million moms, dads, aunts, cousins, anybody who is concerned about our kids' health. And we are banded together to ensure that we're protecting our children from the harmful impacts of air pollution and climate change. And right now, it's needed, I mean, more than ever. In fact, I'm really excited because I'm in D.C. this week for our annual play-in for climate action, where we will have hundreds of moms and kids actually on the lawn of Capitol Hill, standing up for what we believe is important climate action right now. It's also really amazing because we're seeing our kids following our footsteps. I think our children realize that if they don't take up this cause as the thing that will impact their future, they know that they're sitting on borrowed time. So we're very supportive of the youth climate strikes. We'll have speakers that will be there that will be talking, particularly from a youth perspective, about why this is so important. And, you know, we recognize that it is this issue, which is the social justice movement of our time, that we have to be cognizant of and also active in.
That's Heather McTeer-Tony. She's a former regional administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency's Southeast Region under President Barack Obama. And she's currently Moms Clean Air Force National Field Director. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Holocaust survivor Eva Kaur, who championed forgiveness even for those who carried out the Holocaust atrocities, died Thursday during an overseas trip to Poland, where she was promoting the Candles Museum, which she founded in Indiana in 1985. It stands for Children of Auschwitz Nazi Deadly Lab Experiments Survivors. Kaur was a Jewish native of Romania who was sent to the Auschwitz concentration camp in 1944, where most of her family was killed. She and her twin sister survived, but not before being subjected to inhumane medical experiments under the direction of Joseph Mengele.
I personally was injected with deadly germ, and Mengele stood by my bed, never talking to me, but talking to four doctors, telling them, too bad she's so young, she has only 2 weeks to live.
Kaur also gave lectures, wrote an autobiography, and appeared in documentaries sharing her story and message of forgiveness. During the annual trips to Poland, she gave tours of Auschwitz, too. Eva Kaur is survived by her husband, a fellow Holocaust survivor, and their two children. She was 85.
Old pirates, yes, they rabbi, sold I to the merchant.
And in Eva Kaur's memory and her message of forgiveness, it seems fitting that we close out the show today with the last song ever recorded by the late reggae musician Bob Marley, Redemption Song. In 2004, Rolling Stone placed the song at number 66 among the 500 greatest songs of all time.
Triumphantly, won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? Is all I ever have, redemption songs.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charleston Mock. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption songs, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. After several weeks